Up next on Think, extraordinary progress in gene therapy could prevent or cure severe hearing loss. Science writer Dina Fine-Marin will join us this hour to talk about her reporting on the potential use of viruses to deliver doses of healthy genes to the ears of people whose deafness is caused by a genetic defect. We'll hear what researchers have learned from trials on deaf mice and talk about how the treatment, if it does in fact work as well on human subjects, could change the way babies and small children are diagnosed with hearing loss. Our conversation starts after a short break. Babies born in the United States are three who come into the world with genetic defects linked to deafness. Some are born deaf, while others slowly lose the ability to perceive sound. Historically, a diagnosis with one of these diseases gave patients advance notice of their impending deafness, but little hope of meaningful recovery. That could be changing, thanks to rapid improvements in the safety and reliability of gene therapy. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dina Fine-Marin is a science writer. Her article in the December issue of Scientific American, titled Out of the Silence, is about research into gene therapy for deafness, which is promising in mice but has some hurdles to overcome before it can be tested on people. She joins us from NPR in Washington. Dina, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you write about a 24-year-old woman named Hannah who is gradually losing both her hearing and her eyesight. What's causing that?
Yeah, it's a really difficult situation. She has a disease called Usher syndrome. It's a genetic disease that gradually steals her hearing and her sight. And it's because there are issues with her genes that mean that there's faulty hair cells being the damage occurs in hair cells within the inner ear, so the hairs that pick up sound waves from outside and transmit them to the brain aren't working well. And similarly, her retina has trouble picking up light. So over time, her hearing and her sight are getting worse and worse.
So we should note that there are people who are deaf that don't want to be cured of their deafness, that are very happy with this. I would imagine it's a different story for someone who has had experience as a hearing person wanting to hang on to that.
Yeah, Hannah very much so is trying to be an advocate for people who have Usher syndrome like her. She personally is very concerned about her hearing loss and her vision loss that's occurring over time. But as you say, yeah, deafness, some people believe, is not a disease that needs to be fixed. So if this treatment does make its way into people, it would be one available option, but it would have to be up to each individual family and their doctors to decide how to proceed.
Is it just a single bad gene associated with Usher syndrome?
Yeah, it actually is. There are different types of Usher, and each one of them is associated with a defect to a different gene. The type that Hannah Quarterman, the woman that I write about in the article, has is called type 2A, and they've identified one gene in particular that would need to be fixed in her case.
So how was that gene identified?
You know, it actually takes a long time to do that kind of identification, as you would think. So in the 1990s, researchers started to identify families with hearing and vision loss that we now know is typical of Usher. And they compared their genomes, and then they said, we have some data already about some genes that seem to be linked to hearing and to vision. So they zeroed in on those ones and looked for similarities among those people. Then they're like, okay, we have some candidate genes that maybe are behind this. So then they bred mice, both with and without those suspect mutations, to test whether any of the genetic changes were truly responsible for these symptoms. And then they compared them, they pointed their finger at a few specific alterations, and in this case they went, aha, there's a gene called Usher 2A, and that seems to be behind forms of Usher like Hannah has. And that means that if they could have the non-mutated version of the gene, then they could produce healthy hair cells, and that boom would take care of this particular problem, which would be really exciting for patients like Hannah. And that's what they're starting to do in mice.
Yeah, so currently experiments with fixing genetically caused hearing defects are taking place, as you say, in mice. What are the pros and cons of using an animal like a mouse to test gene therapies that you hope might someday work for people?
Yeah, great, great question. Well, we all know mice aren't people, obviously. And mice, of course, are very plentiful. They're very similar to humans in a lot of ways. So a lot of our animal testing occurs in mice before people, as you would expect. So those are the good reasons to do testing on them. And they have the same USHER2A gene that we have, so it's a good proxy. But there are several differences as well that would mean these hurdles would need to be overcome before they could get into humans. For example, the particular gene that would need to be addressed here, that would need to be fixed, it's a pretty big gene in humans. It's like, and the virus that we can get into this more, but the virus that's going to deliver the gene into the body to try to fix this particular problem is a pretty big gene, and it's too big to be sat inside this viral vehicle. It's like you have a plane with a bunch of seats, and then you have more people than the seats. You just can't get them in, so you're going to have to find a different way to deliver it. So that is a problem that would need to be overcome for humans. And the other thing is that a young mouse, developmentally is more similar to a fetus in a human. So while they're able to make this change, this fix in small mice, to have the direct proxy, we would in theory have to be treating humans at a much earlier stage, namely in the fetus, unless we have more technological advances that would mean, okay, aha, we'll have this later in humans when they're babies too.
So most babies and young children who are diagnosed with hearing loss don't necessarily get diagnosed to find out the problem to the level of the gene that's damaged. Is that right?
Yeah, it is right. We're really good in the United States. Most newborns are screened for hearing loss, yet they're rarely diagnosed with a specific disorder or its underlying genetic cause. And that's exactly what happened to Cordeman, who was diagnosed with a genetic problem in high school. So they knew earlier on that she had some hearing deficits, but they didn't know what was behind it. So that would really need to change if children can get treated properly. And so you would need to be doing that gene testing early on, which is something that is not normally done now.
Do most researchers think that actually in the future that will be sort of among the standard protocols for a newborn?
They do. Gene testing is becoming more and more standard place. There's even talk of a future in which we would all get our genome sequenced early in life, and that would tell us a variety of things from, of course, genetic mutations linked to disease to what drugs might be better for us to take because different people break down drugs in different ways depending on their genes. I'd say we're still pretty far from that latter scenario where we all get our genome sequenced, but gene testing for a small panel could be something that could become more common place as the data builds up and as insurance companies become more willing to pay out for those kinds of testing.
So certain kinds of experimentation with gene therapy in human subjects has been in kind of a 20-year deep freeze since mm-hmm. one well-intentioned experiment went horribly wrong. Will you tell us about Jesse Gelsinger?
Sure. So in 1999, there was this 18-year-old boy named Jesse. He had a liver disease, and he was part of a clinical trial for an early gene therapy to try to address his problem. This was with researchers at the University of Pennsylvania. And a virus was used to ferry genes into his body, but the dose and the type of the virus caused his immune system to really overreact, to whip itself into a fatal frenzy, and that led to his immune system attacking his own organs, and he died. And around the same time, there's also another problematic incident with gene therapy where a different viral vehicle was used than what was used with Jesse's, and that caused other serious medical issues. So those two events combined made researchers and the public kind of reticent around gene therapy for a while there.
So most of us non-scientists are sort of trained to hear the word virus and assume mm-hmm. that it's always bad. Can you talk about why viruses were chosen to be the vehicle to deliver these gene therapies in animal subjects and potentially in human subjects?
Sure. So viruses are really good at infecting cells, as we all know, when we get sick. But there are certain viruses that, through trial and error, we found do not make people sick. And since those tragedies 20 years ago, we've been better about selecting the viruses that we would use for a gene therapy. And it looks like certain viruses are really good at infecting certain cells. In this case, the virus that would be used is something called an adeno-associated virus. That's a gene courier that they would use that appears benign to the human immune system and does not harm our cells, but is really good at infecting hair cells. We've learned a lot in the last 20 years about immune system responses. We're better at targeting the cells we want. We've lowered the dose of the virus in some cases that we use as a delivery vehicle so that would keep the immune system from overreacting. So all these things combined make researchers feel much more comfortable using gene therapy. And gene therapy actually is already in use in some cases, not for genetic hearing loss, but recently the U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued its first wave of approvals for gene therapy for people, indicating that really this may be an idea whose time has finally come. In August 2017, the FDA gave its green light to one gene therapy that would be used to treat a form of childhood leukemia. And then in December, the agency approved a gene therapy for a rare inherited form of blindness. In both those cases, it's a viral vehicle that is delivering the goods. So people are seeing that this is really something that is looking like it should be part of standard medical practice for specific maladies.
So you mentioned that one of the improvements that has happened over time was that scientists have learned they can lower the dose of certain things. And yet, I think if I read correctly, you said that the mice are given multiple billions of particles of this virus. So can you explain? I mean, give us some context for how much virus that is.
Yeah, so that sounds like a lot of virus, but you have to remember that it's not all getting to where it's supposed to go, if you will. Mm-hmm. Like if you've ever had a child or a pet that you were giving medication to with a syringe because otherwise they wouldn't take it, and some like dribbles out of their mouth and never makes it to its destination, it's sort of like that, only with gene therapy in this situation. So what you're doing is you're delivering all these viruses that, again, are seemingly benign to our immune system, do not make us sick, and they each have inside of them this correct form of the gene that we are trying to deliver. So they scooped out a lot of the genetic content that would normally be inside of this virus and help it to do the things that viruses normally do. And instead, it's just like a vehicle. And inside, it has this gene, and it's trying to get to its destination. A lot of it won't get to the destination. And eventually, our natural immune system will say, this doesn't look like it belongs here, and throw it out in the trash. But hopefully enough will get to our hair ear cells to do what it is that it's supposed to do.
So is it literally applied to the ears of the mice in question, or how is this therapy delivered?
Exactly. So it is delivered for the mice, it's delivered with a little surgery into its inner ear. If this got into people, I'm told that it would be an injection that would occur sort of into the ear area, and that's how this would happen. So again, the normal viral DNA would get scooped out of this viral vehicle, replaced with these new hair cell genes. Then it would get injected into the inner ear, and there the virus hopefully would infect two types of hair cells called the inner hair cells and the outer hair cells, and that would hopefully lead to better sound detection, and because we'd be replacing the mutated gene that had impaired this ability, so we could produce more healthy proteins, our hair cells would work well, and we could hear.
So one practical question that I can't really get my head around is how scientists obtain the healthy copy of this gene. From where would they harvest something like that?
You know, scientists tell me it's surprisingly easy. Huh. And I'm like, how is this surprisingly easy? And they say, well, we have blueprints in the lab through our years of sequencing work and understanding genes. We know how to synthesize these genes in the laboratory. So they would just literally, the equivalent of you have a recipe, they build them, and then they say, okay, we have these things here. And then they have the virus, the AAV, also in the laboratory, and they through technical steps, even though I'm making it sound very easy, you scoop out the inside of the virus, you plunk in the gene, and boom, you put that all in a solution, you put that in a syringe, and you're good to go.
So you don't necessarily have to replace all of the damaged genes in order to make a difference in terms of function, is that right?
Right, exactly. So you would be hopefully replacing one of the two mutated copies. If you think about it, you know, we all inherit things from our mother and our father. And in this situation, if with Usher syndrome, you have two damaged copies. So scientists have figured out, well, if you can take care of, you know, at least some of this, you could be making a big difference.
My guest is science writer Dina Fine-Marin. We're talking about her article in the December issue of Scientific American titled Out of the Silence. It's about research into gene therapy for deafness. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can go to Twitter, leave us a message @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is science writer Dina Fine Marin, who has an article in the December issue of Scientific American about research into gene therapy for deafness. It's called Out of the Silence. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Dina, could there be any side effect hazard if those fixed genes were to escape to other areas of the body, or were they just sort of be treated by the immune system as things that didn't belong there and eliminated?
Well, there's always a risk. A lot of the reason that scientists have been excited about gene therapy for hearing in particular is that the ear is a relatively self-contained organ, whereas if you were targeting something like the digestive system, where a lot of things are interconnected, the chance of like a quote-unquote spillover off-target effect, meaning something, as you say, going and doing something somewhere else it wasn't supposed to do, would be a bigger problem. And this is one of the things that scientists would definitely want to study further in animals before trying this out in humans. But what scientists have told me is that so far everything looks good. And the mice they did this testing on, there were no negative side effects. They didn't have any off-target effects, as they're called. They didn't get sick. So that makes them feel encouraged that this would likely be okay.
Somebody like Hannah could get a cochlear implant at some point to restore her capacity for hearing. But we should be clear, you describe that as a pretty blunt fix. Can you explain how the experience of hearing with a cochlear implant is really different from natural hearing?
Sure. So the cochlear implant, for those who don't know, is a device that bypasses the hair cells to directly stimulate the auditory nerve, and that gives someone who has this some sense of sound. It's typically given to someone who has really profound hearing loss. And what happens there is you can hear, but it's not with the same level of detail as someone who has the human ear. We have, you know, how your television channel has a lot of different channels. You can click from one to another to another. Hearing is sort of like that. The natural hearing capabilities that we have allows us to hear a lot of different details, a lot of different channels. And whereas we might have hundreds of channels on your normal ear, your normal television set, with the cochlear implant, there's only, let's say, a couple dozen, a much smaller number. I don't have the right figure in front of me, but the point is you just can't hear at the same level. It's a really great, profound breakthrough, the cochlear implant, but it's not the same as our own hearing.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Solomon is calling from Dallas. Hi, Solomon.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
So I'm calling to ask sort of how far can this gene therapy go? I mean, if we can cure deafness, then what other things can we cure?
What's on the horizon, Dina?
Yeah, that's a great, great question, Solomon. Well, honestly, it really depends on what, I guess, you're trying to target. You would have to judge on a case-by-case basis if we know what gene or genes, plural, are involved in a particular malady we're talking about. Then you'd have to know if you have a virus that's good at infecting the cells that you're trying to target. Then you'd have to weigh the risks of the cells getting somewhere they aren't supposed to go, as we were just talking about. And so you'd have to get all those ducks in a row before you could target something else. The reason that Usher syndrome was so exciting to researchers is twofold. One is they knew it was just one cell they had to target, which is relatively rare for maladies. And two is that with a situation like Hannah's, where it was a progressive disease that she was losing her hearing and her vision over time, that gave them a window to try to target something. Some disorders, you know, would have a situation where you would lose all capability right away, and then there's no window to try to fix it. What we're doing here with hearing is you can save the remaining hair cells, and that's something that you can do with every disorder.
What kind of observation takes place in a lab to determine whether or not a mouse can hear anything?
Yeah, I found that part really interesting when I was doing research for this story. So part of it is what you would think. You do testing to see if the mouse can hear. You do sort of startle tests where you expose them to a loud sound and you see if they jump. But also because the inner ear is so involved in our sense of balance, mice that have hearing deficits often have really a lot of problems with their balance. So, for example, mice, unlike people, instinctively know how to swim. When you put a mouse in water, it automatically starts paddling away. But with mice that have been genetically modified to have disorders like I'm talking about in this story, when you put them in water, they start they start to drown. They start paddling frantically. They don't know what they're doing until a researcher quickly scoops them up. So that's something to think about. And also, these same mice, when they have these disorders, if you put a mouse normally in an open area, it'll sniff around. It'll start exploring. Mice are a curious sort. But when they have this disorder, because they're dizzy, they just sort of cower in a corner, and they don't really know up from down, and they're very uncomfortable. And so because of that, you can see, well, okay, let's see, once we do this gene therapy and we wait a few weeks, we do these same tests, we put them out in an open area, you see how they act. You put them in the water, you see what they do. You can put them on a little rotating rod and see if they manage to stay on top of it without falling down. Mm-hmm. And those are all the tests that you typically do in a lab.
So you saw these mice that had been treated, and you kept saying, mm-hmm. are you sure these aren't the control mice?
Right. Yeah, I visited a lab where these mice had been modified weeks earlier, and they just performed so normally that I was like, are you sure you're showing me the right ones? Are you sure? But scientists, of course, have good methods for tracking their animals, and they, you know, keep them all separated and labeled. So they were like assuring me, oh, yes, these are the ones. And so it was pretty impressive to see.
Mice, of course, don't live a long time, even under the best of circumstances. I'm wondering if scientists believe that you could do one fix by replacing some genes and that would be it, or would human patients conceivably have to go back every year or every 5 years for another treatment?
The hope is that you would only have to do this once, and that would be enough, because you'd be delivering the instructions to your hair cells saying, okay, guys, this is what you're supposed to do. This is how you're supposed to do it. And that instruction would stay in the system. Whether or not that would actually end up being the case is still a bit up in the air. But scientists tell me that they think that would be the way it would work just once.
All right, let's go back to the phones. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Jamie in Midlothian. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
I have a son with a rare genetic syndrome, and this syndrome causes intellectual disabilities along with many other genetic syndromes. And I was wondering if there's been any success with impacting the intellectual disability and improving capacity, and also what kind of side effects occur when these type of therapies are provided for children.
Thanks for calling, Jamie.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks so much for the question. I am not familiar with any gene therapy research that's been done with intellectual disability. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened. That just means I'm not familiar with it. But I would imagine, since intellectual disabilities are often due to a variety of factors and also a variety of genes from what scientists know at the time, that this would be something really difficult to target with our current knowledge. But definitely talk to a doctor about this, or a researcher, not me.
What are the most important signs that scientists look for in animal trials to determine whether they've arrived at something that it appears at least to be safe to test on humans?
Yeah, so typically what they want to do is have either several different labs who have come up with the same result as theirs, even though, let's say, the first lab has replicated this hundreds of times, or they also often would like to try more than one animal model. So if something looks good in rodents, it typically will then be tried in a larger mammal, whether that's a non-human primate, meaning a monkey, or a dog. Those are two models that are often used as sort of step two before it goes to humans. In rare cases, things might also move from rodent directly to human, but that's pretty infrequent. And with something like this, the researchers all said that they would definitely want to try this in further trials with rodents and then with larger mammals before they came to humans.
All right, 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Gabrielle calling from Keller. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hi, I was wondering if the researcher found any problems with parents or researchers who will dissuade parents and from teaching their children American Sign Language because they're hoping to get a cure by therapy or cochlear implant, and then the children end up getting behind in school because they can't hear.
Do you know anything about that, Dina?
Sorry, that's a bit outside my lane. I'm not familiar with that. I know that is an ongoing controversy about the culture of deafness and making sure that American Sign Language is continue to be taught in a variety of settings, but I don't know of any situation where, at least with this gene therapy, that people are excited enough about it that they're making plans as if they or their children would be exposed to the gene therapy in the near future.
So it looks like we're years out if, in fact, this turns out to work for humans at all.
Exactly.
So you mentioned earlier that the form of Usher syndrome that Hannah has also affects her eyes. Are these mm-hmm. treatments potentially convertible to be used on the problems there?
Supposedly, yeah, that's one of the reasons researchers are really excited about it. The idea being that they would use the same viral vehicle, they would use the same approach, only they'd be doing these injections into the eye to try to do this same treatment. Now, whether or not that will actually work as well is still very much up in the air. Those trials have not started for Usher syndrome specifically yet, but FDA did already approve a gene therapy for a different rare inherited form of blindness, so there is a lot of excitement about treating vision deficits with gene therapy.
Is a lot of this research happening in the private sector, at the university level? Is it happening at drug companies? Is it possible to characterize who's sort of taking the lead on this kind of thing?
Yeah, it's difficult to say because often when things are being done in the private sector, they don't talk about it that much mm-hmm. until they have something sort of patent ready. I am hearing that pharmaceutical companies and venture capitalists are generally putting a lot of money into gene therapy research. And typically, a lot of research in America is done, the early stage, the basic research is done funded by us as the taxpayers. The National Institutes of Health will sponsor work that's done at a university level, for example. And then they hand it off to private companies and researchers to work on in the later stages. And the way the system is set up is that so it takes some of the difficulties out of having to get over that early basic research. So NIH supports that early work. And then if it looks somewhat promising, the hope is that pharmaceutical companies will say, okay, yeah, let's put some money into that and further develop it. And that's how it's been for decades here in the U.S.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Jackson calling from Denton. Hey, Jackson.
Hi. I was wondering, in regards to safety, how do you know when you edit or do gene therapy that when you change a gene, it doesn't change something that you weren't expecting that could potentially have, like, negative outcomes for the patient?
Thanks for calling.
Well, that's actually a big controversy right now. In regards to this specific approach I'm talking about here, this is a gene therapy where you're just delivering something new. You're not editing the gene, meaning you didn't make a change to the existing gene. You just delivered something new. But a big controversy that's happening right now is with CRISPR. As you may have heard of, that's a molecular scissors approach to modify a gene. You'd create a potential therapy for a human. You'd mutate a gene in a lab animal. You might craft some changes in bugs that render them incapable of transmitting a disease like malaria, for example. CRISPR is this immune system in bacteria that has been adapted to edit the DNA of other organisms. And actually, in my feature, I talk about some recent progress that's happened with a CRISPR gene therapy and hearing to treat one malady in particular by cutting out a problematic gene that they know is behind a hearing problem. And yeah, it's a good question about learning more about why genes do what they do. Could they have other responsibilities that we're not aware of? That continues to be discussed in the scientific community.
It's really interesting to think about the potential. If we were to get to a place where we sequenced people very early in life or even in mm-hmm. utero, delivering therapies before a progressive congenital disease even had a negative effect.
Yeah, that's really the hope, I mean, for some scientists, saying, well, we could stop things in their tracks. We could cut that off and we could make sure that you never got sick from this particular issue. That's, I guess, the hope. But, I mean, there are so many obstacles about identifying things at the fetal stage, doing surgery at the fetal stage, you know, and then paying for it too, of course. There are a lot of factors to think about.
And I suppose there's also the potential that if these things worked, they would be like the victim of their own success. You know, once you do it, you think, did I really need to do that or would it not have developed in the first place? In the same way that some people mm-hmm. Think that vaccines have been a victim of their own success.
Right, sure. And relatedly, for vaccines, it's been very difficult to get pharmaceutical companies to with antibiotics, they suffer from the same problem. And pharmaceutical companies, it's difficult to get them to develop new classes of antibiotics because, you know, in some ways they're shooting themselves in the foot. It's not necessarily as deliberately thought out in that specific way, but it is an economic reality that if you have a drug that already works well, why would you make more drugs that, you know, would be kept in that would be kept in the reserve to be used if the first drug wasn't used because you're not making money when people aren't using those drugs.
All right, let's go next on the phone to Alex in Grapevine. Hi, Alex.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is really about long-term adoption. I would like to know just the opinion, because I view this kind of as how the nuclear age got started early on. It was a lab project and it was just done a certain way, and then now it's just kind of an accepted fact of life that we had. What happens if this takes off considerably faster than people actually think it was going to, and how does that affect us ethically?
Thanks for calling.
Well, I guess to unpack the question a bit, in regards to this taking off for deafness specifically, though hearing loss is one of the most common birth defects, affecting as many as 3 of every 1,000 babies, genetic flaws are responsible for like half of those cases. And so if this took off a lot for hearing deficits, meaning for Usher, and then if they developed it for other things, I think most folks in the scientific or medical community, assuming this works well, would be pretty excited about that. When it comes to hearing loss, there are 3 main reasons we have it. One is we lack those hair cells in the inner ear that we need. The second is we damage them somehow, you know, with like loud noise exposure. And the third is those nerve fibers, for whatever reason, are no longer communicating well between the ear and the brain. So if we could knock out those reasons, that'd be really helpful.
My guest is science writer Dina Fine-Marin. Her article in the December issue of Scientific American is called Out of the Silence. It's about research into gene therapy, specifically for congenital deafness. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with science writer Dina Fine-Marin about her article in the December issue of Scientific American called Out of the Silence. It's about research into gene therapy for deafness. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter @KERAThink. So you, Dina, are a garden variety science writer. You really cover the waterfront. Not too long ago, you had a piece actually in National Geographic about something that's really interesting. More and more elephants are being born without tusks in Mozambique. What's the reason behind this, do researchers think?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Right, so I wrote about how in Mozambique's Gorongosa National Park, where there was a civil war that gripped the country for 15 years, and during that civil war, poachers were killing a lot of elephants for their tusks so they could get money, and also they would eat the meat of the elephants. And obviously, elephants that had a rare genetic change where only, this is about 2-4% of female African elephants, don't get born with tusks. So they leave those elephants behind because they didn't have tusks. And as the lone survivors of that conflict that killed about 90% of the animals, then those elephants had kids and those kids didn't have tusks often either. And that's because they had a biological advantage because they were the only ones left. And recent figures suggest about 1/3 of younger females, this is the generation born after the poaching happened, those never developed tusks. That's a huge increase. And Mozambique isn't the only place that's seeing this. Poachers are truly putting pressure on elephant communities to lose their tusks. For example, in Tanzania, there was a lot of poaching in the 1970s and 80s, which again gave tuskless elephants a similar biological advantage. So 35% of those older elephants had no tusks. And then they had their kids, and at least the daughters, 13% of the daughters had no tusks. And again, the baseline level should have been 2-4%. So again, big increase. But researchers do not know exactly why that genetic change is happening. They haven't really studied tusklessness in elephants. And so there's big study happening right now where a lot of the elephants in Mozambique get collars put on them, or pardon me, not a lot, just I think it's six. I don't have the story in front of me, sorry. But six of the elephants are collared. They're looking at where they go and what they do. And they're trying to get a sense of, does it matter if you don't have these tusks? They seem to be pretty healthy, the elephants, from the outside, but they don't know, well, tusks are used for a lot of things by elephants. They use them to dig up their food, they use them and water, they use them to rub against trees, which helps to get food for them, but also to create habitat for other creatures that live around them, like lizards, for example, live in the trees that the elephants knocked down or roughed up. So they know these things matter on some level, and they're wondering, well, do elephants and the creatures around them just adapt when the elephants don't have tusks? Or is something important happening here and we just don't understand it yet?
It's a remarkably fast adaptation to a threatening condition in their environment, isn't it?
It's really, really fast, yeah. And exactly why this is happening, they don't know, but they're seeing it over and over. And they know that, of course, poachers are behind the initial reason that there were so many elephants without tusks. But it isn't just tusklessness that's being influenced by hunters. Researchers are also seeing again and again that it's also pushing tusk size smaller, meaning poachers, as you would expect, try to target elephants that have bigger tusks, because bigger tusk means more money, and therefore elephants with smaller tusks are being left behind. Those are the ones that are still around to procreate, thus their kids have smaller tusks. And you're seeing situations where when researchers measure tusk size in certain communities in Africa and in Asia, they're seeing these shrinking tusks.
And is this affecting females and males as well?
Yeah, the interesting thing is they're seeing the phenomenon in Africa in female elephants, not in males, and they don't know why that could be. It makes sense if you think about it that an elephant that didn't have tusks, a male, wouldn't be as good at competing for a female. So, okay, it makes sense from that standpoint. But as far as females still are having baby girls and baby boys, and the baby boys are developing the tusks still. So they're like, well, why could that be? Elephants, like people, have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. And so they're like, well, is this something that's passed on from mother to daughter? And thus it would be on the X chromosome? They don't think so, because the X chromosome is passed on to the son as well. So exactly why it's not occurring in the males but is occurring in the females has got them stumped.
And I wonder if ultimately the lack of tusks will shape the behavior of these female elephants.
Yeah, they're really wondering a lot about that, especially when it comes to food. So again, the tusks are used to help them get food off trees, this important fiber they need for digestion and protein, but they still seem to be eating enough. So they're wondering, well, do they need to venture much further afield to find trees that have already been, you know, knocked down that they can eat, or that other elephants in their community are consciously or not helping prepare food for them? So like, you know, a little bark would all be ripped off and then they could work around it by using their trunk to still eat it. Is that what's happening? They don't know. So that's part of the thing that's being studied right now by this bigger American and Mozambique research group. And I'm hoping to have answers on that in the next couple of years.
So from elephants in Africa, let's go to bats in Bolivia. People are drinking bat blood because they think it will cure what ails them.
Yeah, that's a true story. I wrote about how in Bolivia, where traditional medicine is very prevalent in the belief. In fact, legislatively, the traditional medicine is on par with traditional biomedicine, meaning Western medicine. And one belief system says that the fresh blood of a bat should be able to help you treat the seizures that are associated with epilepsy. And as a result of that, a researcher in Bolivia who's been studying bat communities and markets where bats are sold has found that more than 3,000 bats a month have been sold in the marketplaces. These are fresh bats, or bats that died during transit, and it's for, and they think it's for this particular purpose. Yeah. The exact reason behind why the belief is that bats could help cure seizures in this way is a little obtuse. Researchers aren't really sure. I talked to one anthropologist who studies Bolivia, and she said, well, two factors you should think about. The first is that blood is viewed as something very powerful. It's a powerful life force. So if you're consuming that, maybe that could help. And the second factor is bats are kind of a weird creature if you think about it. They're mammals, but they fly. They're sort of, they defy categories in this way. And because they're so irregular, that might make them powerful. And if, for that reason as well, maybe they could help treat something that is an irregularity in the human, namely a seizure, something abnormal and upset. And that's why people think that this could work. I want to be clear, there's no evidence that this will work or that it does work, but this is one belief system.
So if this is a traditional belief, presumably people have been hunting for bats to give to their sick loved ones for some time. Is the problem that now populations have grown and there's just a greater demand for these animals?
Well, there isn't a really good handle on exactly how often this is happening. They know from these market surveys that they looked in four cities and they did this market survey and they said, at least 3,000 of these are being killed. The problem isn't really that now bats are going to be endangered because of this. The problem is, for the bats, a problem is that if you go to a specific area where bats are living and you kill all the bats in that particular area, that's really bad for that bat community. Obviously, that roost will be very different or won't exist anymore. It's a bigger concern in some ways for human populations for a few reasons. The first is that bats often eat bugs, and bugs, mosquitoes, for example, we know are carriers of a variety of diseases, which extends to malaria, of course, but more recently has been linked with Zika virus. These are things that humans don't want to encounter. The other thing is that bats, certain bats, not all bats, but certain bats do carry rabies. And when you're interacting with this live bat, whether it be to catch it or to sell it or to prepare it, you could get exposed to a bite from this bat and you too could get rabies, which is very serious. And the third thing is that bats themselves have been linked to a variety of diseases, so not the mosquitoes, but the bat, extending to Marburg virus, Ebola. Neither of these naturally occur in Bolivia, which is a good thing, or at least we haven't picked them up there. But researchers say, well, if you're eating fresh bat blood, you might be exposing yourself to pathogens that could be novel or pathogens that we don't know are problematic yet because the survey systems, the health surveillance systems just may not be capturing when someone gets sick. It was because they had fresh bat blood. We might not be connecting those dots yet. So these are things you really need to be thinking about. I don't want to fearmonger and say that Ebola is going to occur in Bolivia. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that bats have been linked to a variety of maladies, and when you're exposing yourself in this way, it's something that public health researchers and physicians are concerned about.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In a lot of places, bats are also an important and maybe under-recognized source of vector control because, as you say, they eat insects. There are fewer insects around to bite humans and their livestock.
Yeah, exactly. And so as a result, for that reason, it's not great when there's more threats to the bat communities. The biggest threats to bats that live in Bolivia are more traditional in the sense that, you know, it's habitat destruction when people are building up in areas and things like that. But when it comes to drinking bats' blood, this is another serious threat.
So what's the approach to this? I mean, do people think that maybe going into communities and trying to educate them or give them some alternative therapy might be successful?
Well, the movement that I'm hearing about now is more about education, educating people, you know, going into communities and saying, hey, bats really aren't going to help cure your epilepsy. You should see a physician. These are the reasons why, and these are why bats are valuable. But again, since traditional medicine is so prevalent in Bolivia, it's difficult to change people's minds when this is something that's been done by their family for a long time, for many generations. And so, you know, if you love your loved one, you might be trying to do everything you think could be available to help them. And it's hard to break this chain of thought when you might say, okay, well, this person that I gave bat blood to, now they're having another seizure. Does that mean that it doesn't work? No, maybe that's not what it means. Maybe it just means they need another new bat. So it's difficult to convince people.
Yeah, and by the same token, people might say, well, I went to a Western doctor and that doctor couldn't completely control this condition that my loved one has.
True, exactly so.
Can you talk a little bit about how you find your way to your next story?
Yeah, a lot of my story ideas come from either the fact that I'm curious, I'll see a nugget of something, you know, I'll be reading a report and there'll be just a casual sentence mentioning something and I'm like, wait, what? Hmm. Or I'll be speaking to an expert for one story and they'll mention something else that they've seen that's weird and that will lead me to dive into something new. When it comes to the gene therapy story, I was on staff as an editor and writer at Scientific American and I was talking to a researcher who told me, hey, well, did you know in the last year there have been several studies that have come out in mice that about gene therapy making some progress? And I didn't know that. And then I read the studies, talked to the authors that wrote them, and that got me started on that topic. Now I'm the senior investigative reporter at National Geographic focusing on wildlife crime. So all my days are filled with learning fascinating and disturbing things about how humans are interacting with wildlife. And when I talk to a researcher or when I talk to a nonprofit, they'll tell me what's on their radar and that might lead to the next story.
Does a focus on wildlife crime tend to leave you pretty pessimistic about the future of wildlife on this planet?
Honestly, it's difficult not to be pessimistic when you hear some of the terrible things that people are doing. But when you take a step back and see all the people that are working so hard to help protect animals and all the animal communities that are really bouncing back over time, that does give me hope. Later this year in May, a lot of countries come together for this major meeting that's talking about the international treaty that regulates the trade of wildlife.
CITES, and, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And at the CITES meeting, people will be bringing forth new proposals to say, hey, this animal we've been tracking or this species we've been tracking is not doing so well and we need to take new steps to protect it. Laws aren't enough, enforcement matters, and it's interesting to see what communities on the ground are trying to do to help these animals and of course, timber and plants as well. It's not just animals.
Dina Fine-Marin is a science writer. We've talked mostly today about her article in the December issue of Scientific American titled Out of the Science. You can also read her work in National Geographic. Dina, this has been really interesting. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with us.
Thanks for the conversation, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
You can follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. My personal Twitter handle is @ChrisBoydThink. You can use any podcast app you're familiar with and that you like to subscribe to the KERA Think podcast. You can find out about upcoming shows at our website. That's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.